Hello and welcome to the MVP, the Mass Violence Podcast, the official podcast of the National Mass Violence Victimization Resource Center. I'm Dan Smith, the Director of Resources and Technology for the NMVVRC. In some of our previous episodes, we've had great conversations with victim advocates, mental health providers, politicians, members of the news media, and researchers. But surprisingly, we've never had a guest whose expertise and experience was in law enforcement. Well, that streak ends today, and I'm very happy to welcome Kristen Zeman, former police chief in Aurora, Illinois, to the MVP. Welcome, Chief Zeman.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. Kristen Zeman has a 30-year career in law enforcement and was definitely a trailblazer. She was the first woman lieutenant in the Aurora Police Department in 2008, the first woman commander in 2010, and then in 2016, she became the first woman chief. Since retiring last year from active duty, she's gone on to start a new career as a professional consultant and speaker with expertise in leadership development, in the empowerment of women, and, kind of relevant for today, mass shooting prevention. Ms. Zeman is also the author of Reimagining Blue, Thoughts on Life, Leadership, and a New Way Forward in Policing, which is her memoir about serving in a misunderstood profession from the vantage point of a female police chief. So, Kristen, in February 2019, you were the chief of police when Aurora experienced a mass shooting. And when that call came in and you knew for the first time that you were responding to a mass violence tragedy, what were the first few thoughts to go through your mind?
Wow. Well, I can tell you that it was the absolute worst day of my professional career. And I had become police chief in 2016. And in doing so, in starting that tenure, you know, I did what I thought was right as far as preparation. And I went to my team and said, hey, if, you know, the boogeyman were to show up in our city, are we prepared for the unthinkable, for the worst thing that could possibly happen? And as it turned out, we weren't ready. And I give you that backstory because it becomes so important for the day, you know, the incident that actually occurred. But during that time, you know, my SWAT commander and lieutenant said, no, our equipment is expired. We need extra training, not only for our line level officers, but for our special response SWAT team. And so beginning in 2016, we got ready. Our training division did a remarkable job getting our people ready. And even so, when you think that you are prepared, it still doesn't prepare you for that moment in time. And for me, it was February 15th, a Friday afternoon at 1:24 p.m. And I was sitting in my office with another commander, and we were talking about very high-level police executive stuff. He was actually sharing with me a recipe for a lemon caper sauce that he had put on his fish the night before. And remember, it's Friday afternoon, you know? And so we have to bring a little levity here. And it was in that moment that another commander ran in and said, are you listening to the radio? And we looked at each other and we had this moment of no, what are you talking about? You know, the radio was on low. And he said, we have an active shooter. And I don't know quite how to describe, you know, with language, the feelings that went through me. It was this split second moment in time, but it felt like an eternity as those words hung there. We have an active shooter. And then it was as if a switch flipped and we were tripping over each other to get out the door, grabbed my vest, my radio, and, you know, all of the things we needed. And we were en route to the scene. And it was en route to the scene that it became real to me, because over the radio, I heard one of the officers say, I've got four victims in an office, and then they found another victim. So five were killed in total. And then the unthinkable, I hear one officer get shot, another officer get shot, a total of five officers are shot in trying to stop this shooter from killing. And so, you know, this is that moment where I think this is it. This is not a drill. And again, it was just, I had this moment of emotion, and then that emotion had to be flipped off immediately. And then it became, what needs to be done? Who do I need to notify? I'm incident command. How do we manage this scene? And then it became business at that point.
Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds harrowing, to say the least. I'm curious, you mentioned that when you first started, you asked your staff, are we ready for the boogeyman, or, you know, some version of that question. I'm curious what made you ask that question? Why did that come to mind as a question to ask your staff?
I, at that point, as a commander and becoming chief, I was going through the Naval Postgraduate School, the Center for Homeland Defense, and I was working on my second master's degree. And that master's degree is in Homeland Security. And my molecules were scrambled during that learning, during that higher education, those 3 years of my life, because it turned my focus to what is the worst thing that could possibly happen? And are you prepared? And now that I was chief, I started to think like that. And I promise I'm still really fun at parties, but my head tends to go to what's the worst thing that could possibly happen. And so that was the question that I asked my staff. And it came from just that process of learning.
Gotcha. I mean, that seems so important. And I know that we're going to talk a little bit later in our conversation about preparation and so forth. But it sounds like that was an important question to have asked. As you were driving to the scene and as you arrived, and I'm correct in remembering that the shooting took place at a plant in Aurora. Is that correct?
That's correct. It was a manufacturing plant. So it was a workplace violence.
Right.
It was an employee who was being terminated on that day, a 15-year veteran. And during the termination meeting, he opened fire on those individuals who were running the meeting, and even his union representation, and a young intern whose first day on the job that day as a human resource intern, about to graduate from a local university. He was also in the office on that day as well.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
When you got there, and as you were, you know, leading the response, what were some of the challenges that you faced first when responding?
First and foremost, it was the mental notion for me to go right towards the scene. You know, I've been an officer for, you know, 20 something years, and in all of our active shooting, you know, preparation and training, we are trained to run towards the gunfire. And for the three of us, the three, you know, command level people who were, you know, on the way to the scene, we wanted to go, especially here upon hearing my officers are being shot. You know, I know them, I know their families, and I wanted to go right there. And so that was just kind of the emotional barrier that I had was, I can't do that. I have a job to do. And that's when I say that flipped a switch. It became, you know, what now do I have to do? The most challenging part were managing the resources. And so on one hand, what a positive in knowing that when an incident like this happens, when the defecation hits the oscillation, not only did my department show up both on duty and off duty, but so did seemingly every police department in the state of Illinois, neighboring jurisdictions and beyond. And so if you can picture this chaotic event where there is a mass shooter inside a 300,000 square foot warehouse, and we're trying to set up command, you know, in a warm zone away from the incident and start to manage the resources and send them towards the inner perimeter incident commander, it was a very difficult thing to do to try to determine who was there. And it seemed like it was insurmountable at times. And then things just started to kind of go into flow as we had all of the SWAT teams line up and had all the AMBOs line up and stage. And basically it became an assembly line, and it turned into put me in, coach, wherever you need us, we'll go. But that was the most challenging part in the middle of the incident. And then of course, that was my most challenging, that notwithstanding the SWAT lieutenant who ran the inner perimeter operations and determining how to find a shooter who was now it was a big game of hide and go seek. We knew, you know, five cops were shot, five people were dead. And now to go on a game of hide and seek to find a shooter in this warehouse, and that took 90 minutes to find him.
Wow. That's amazing. I guess the next question I have is, eventually the shooter was terminated by police fire. And I'm curious at that point, like, what is the role of law enforcement once the situation, I don't want to say is under control, because you've got injured people there, you've got chaos, but how does law enforcement transition from oh my gosh, there's an active shooter and we have to find him, we have to play hide and seek in this enormous warehouse. Once the game of hide and seek is over, then what?
Yeah. And so what's so interesting about that is, you know, this game of hide and seek is operations. It's the thing that law enforcement is good at. We're good at tactical operations, especially a well-trained department. And so, you know, the challenge, of course, was finding the shooter. The shooter ultimately retreated back to his own workspace, which is just an interesting tidbit, you know, of irony, or maybe even a little psychology there. He reverted to where he was comfortable. But in the course of over 90 minutes, they were deploying flashbangs, which really sound like gunfire, and pushing him back, you know, into the warehouse. He then opened fire upon the SWAT team that confronted him, and they returned fire. So you look at that event, and I remember that moment standing in the command post when they said the shooter had been neutralized, and I almost fell to my knees and just, you know, in relief. And yet in that moment, it's not done. Mm-hmm. So now we have to determine, are there other victims in the building? So we knew that there were five deceased, but we didn't know if he had shot others. It turns out he had one other who had actually escaped and flagged down a vehicle. But now it becomes looking for more victims and trying to find employees. Did they flee? Are they inside? Are they hiding? And then, of course, managing a crime scene. So this now becomes a crime scene. We have, you know, an officer involved shooting, a homicide, and now this becomes an active investigation, which means that, you know, the plant is secure, evidence tape goes up, and, you know, the experts in evidence come in. And, you know, and then, of course, tending to the victims and the deceased and the victims' families, and making notifications, and the reunification center of employees and of officers' families who, you know, showed up at our department, not knowing if it was their police officer that was shot. And we didn't know the status of the officers as well. And so having to, you know, manage this scene without knowing if my officers were even going to pull through, all of that, I mean, and I could go on. And then it becomes, you know, the managing of a community who is in mourning, you know, and then fundraisers. I mean, I didn't sleep for 2 weeks straight after, you know, the incident. So it just, so it's not just the incident alone. And those were the lessons that I learned, you know, after the fact, that when the shooting stops and the scene is contained, there is so much more, particularly surrounding human beings and emotions.
That was actually, you know, a great segue into my next question. I was going to ask you about lessons learned. I mean, as far as I know, Aurora did not have another mass shooting after this one. But what kinds of lessons did you and the Aurora Police Force learn from February 15th, 2019?
Well, I can tell you first and foremost, the top three lessons learned, and forgive my redundancy, but they are training, training, and training. We put our officers prior to this event through experiential training, scenario-based training, meaning we sent them into schools, abandoned buildings, and set up scenarios that were real with actors, volunteer actors, with simmunitions to completely simulate what an active shooter event would feel like in a high-stress situation. And because our training division did a remarkable job in setting those up, our officers knew how to perform. They knew to run towards the gunfire and not retreat. Even after getting hit one by one, they continued to press on to stop the killing, stop the bleeding. And that's what you can hope for. Hope is not a strategy, naturally, but that is precisely what we expect. We do not rise to the level of our expectations. We fall to the level of our training. And so the biggest lesson learned is that, you know, in departments going forward, you have to train for the unthinkable and you have to use your imagination as to what it might be. And so because we got ready, those officers that day, listen, I just happened to be the chief of police of this, you know, 300 person organization on that day. It was those officers, our training officers, that prepared our first responders. And they did a remarkable and heroic job that day, stopping other people from getting shot, other employees from getting killed. And so that would be the thing that I would say to departments going forward is that you can't just do a tabletop, you know, or watch some videos. You have to put people through this kinds of training. And that's the lesson that I learned. And fortunately, we learned that we did it right. Now, naturally, we had a lot of other things after the fact that we needed to tweak. For example, our SWAT team was, after this event, was given take-home squad cars, because by the time they got to the police department, you know, to get suited up, to get into, you know, their SWAT gear and into the Bearcat, that's precious time. Those are lives lost. And so, you know, we tweaked some things. And of course, comms. Comms are always the first thing that go wrong, and we couldn't communicate with other agencies that showed up. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we developed ways to patch in radios, but those are operational and those are really procedural and systems that needed to be tweaked. But you know, the first and foremost is that those officers absolutely responded in the way that they were trained to do. And for me, that was the biggest win for us. And that's the lesson learned.
That's really impressive. And you mentioned all of the different steps that your training officers and your SWAT team and your force went through. Is that a typical method of training for other kinds of specialty responses, or is that something that's unique to a mass violence training?
So I will say that it's unique in the sense that, you know, every state, and this is where it gets a little complex as far as police training, is that every state has, you know, different standards to which a police department, you know, must adhere. And those are minimum standards. And so, you know, I'll say first that our department took the minimum standards, but then added, you know, six more full days of training above and beyond what is required. And so that's not typical, you know. And then responding to mass violence, it's difficult to train because every incident is different, right? I mean, so you've got, you know, mass violence taking place at the Walmart, at the synagogue, you know, at a church, you know, at a school, at a warehouse, a workplace. And so you have to modify and almost do, you know, kind of a generic training, but that still has the same impact and where you can really respond where, you know, as far as principles and, you know, operational principles, because those are standard across the board. And then, you know, as you enter the backdrop, we've got one shooter, two shooters, you know, and then you adapt. And so that's what the basis of the training is foundational, is really, it's the mindset of courage to run towards things. And that is really what we train in these events, no matter what the backdrop. And then when the backdrop happens, then we just modify our response based on, you know, where it's occurring and, you know, and as the situation unfolds.
Okay. And that's different from other kinds of trainings that you all go through, or is that kind of the same basic template?
So it's a little different. You know, there's a lot of different trainings. We have defensive tactics training. We have barricaded subject training. We have hostage negotiation training. You know, there really is a gamut of training. And that's what we tried to do in our department, is to expose our officers to all different kinds of events, you know, including a suicide, you know, by cop. We did, our training division put our officers through that. De-escalation training, which, you know, is so important as officers are especially in this day and age where you see the negative headlines of police officers doing the wrong thing. And so it really all comes down to a gamut of training, you know, and then trusting the officers in that moment to look at the scenario as it unfolds and to adapt accordingly.
Gotcha. That sounds like you could keep a police force pretty much constantly busy doing training.
Exactly.
with the variety. Is that a challenge as you manage a force to sort of balance? You actually need police on the street, and yet we also need to train them up.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Dan, because that is the biggest impediment to police departments. Is the first thing to go when a budget is cut is typically the training budget, because it's abstract, right? It's like you can put your officers, like we did. We put our officers through this training over the course of several years, and guess what? Nothing happened, you know? And so you can say, well, you know, nothing has happened, so let's just cut the corners here, you know, slice that training. Because I will tell you, as a police chief who has been at odds with our the CFO, the chief financial officer of the city, who looked at me and said, your training budget is exorbitant because we have to hire overtime for the officers who are in the 8-hour training. So the street, to your point, has to be covered because 911 calls don't stop even when we're in the middle of a training exercise. And to put a large department, like we're considered a mid-sized department, so over 300 officers, but to put them through that training costs a lot of money because of the overtime and backfill that we have to cover the street. And so it's a hefty price tag. And I looked at my CFO and I said, you will have to pry my training budget out of my cold, dead hands. And he laughed. And after this incident, he understood that this is what we train for. We train every day for the thing that may or may not happen, but God forbid that we are not prepared and at the ready for when it does happen. And when we don't have that training, we are not at the ready. And that's why we have to change our mindset about putting that investment towards our people and training. It costs a lot of money, but we just have to accept it to prepare for the unthinkable.
Yeah. That sounds so pertinent given some of the stories that we've heard this year about what appears to be sort of lack of law enforcement readiness in certain incidents. And, you know, just sort of hearing you talk about how important it is to train and drill, you know, really sort of put some of those instances in a different light in my to my way of hearing. But it's a huge challenge, and it makes you wonder if other communities had leaders who were as effective and as assertive as you were in fighting off their CFOs to maintain training budgets and so forth.
Yeah, and that's the challenge. It truly is. I mean, I understand the plight because, you know, money is tight in cities. And so, but again, that is where you have to commit. You know, if you think about it, even as de-escalation, you know, in that kind of training, I've argued many times and truly until, you know, I'll keep arguing until I no longer have a voice, is that, you know, even de-escalation and these kind of scenario-based trainings, even when you're training for an active shooter, you build in de-escalation to that. And what that does is, you know, that helps officers perform because of the muscle memory when they go through these trainings in high stress. And then they perform de-escalation in every single one of the scenarios put on as well. Now, think about that. Once they perform de-escalate, that's less money spent on lawsuits later for excessive force cases. And so, I mean, I can make the business case all day long for spending the money on the front end on training so you're not paying it on the back end for, you know, malfeasance.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I'm a, you know, a lowly psychologist and neither a CFO nor a police chief, but there is a certain logic to the argument that you're putting forward there that's inescapable to me. In the past couple of weeks, we've seen some more mass shootings around the country. And unfortunately, it doesn't really seem like there's a downward trend to these kinds of events. And I'm just wondering, from your perspective as now someone who is serving as an expert and a consultant, if you were advising current police chiefs, what would you say the most important thing or things that they need to be ready for are?
So as I mentioned, you know, I can't emphasize enough the training and the readiness, but here's the rub. Law enforcement, we are first responders. And the key word in this sentence, as I'm going to extrapolate, is respond. And so we respond to these events. And I would love to believe that we live on the prevention side. We try, right, through training. And so we have to live in the readiness side, basically defense. And, you know, and so kind of what I've already mentioned about training, we have to put our officers through that training so they know what to do when they get there. Another point I'll underscore there is, as we've seen across the nation, and I'll use myself as an example, I was not on a tactical trajectory in my police department. So I'm not the person that it should be on the inner perimeter, you know, going in for the grid search, because that's not my area of expertise. So a police chief needs to understand what their role is. I understood my role that day was really more of an administrative role, managing resources. And I understood earlier, you know, that putting people in the right place in their role is the SWAT commander, the SWAT lieutenant, and making sure that those individuals know exactly what they are doing on the inner perimeter in the grid search and, you know, going through the building, the tactics, the operations, right? And so I think that's important for a police chief to understand, is that it's okay if you lead your organization and yet you're not the one running in. You need to make sure that the people who are running in are the ones who are highly trained and skilled to do so. And so I guess the point there is know what your role is and provide roles for other people, and then get the hell out of the way and let them do their job. And that's what we did right that day, is we all stayed in our lanes. And again, I was able to manage resources while, you know, the tactical guys were able to go in and take care of business. But let me go backwards. What I think it's even more of an onus that lays upon our communities, because the prevention lies in people, in communities. The next mass shooter is sitting in a cubicle next to you, is living in the basement or a bedroom in your house, is someone that is walking the hallways of a school near you or with your kid. And we know this, and I don't mean to sound dramatic, but again, that's kind of where I live now, in, you know, that space of preparation. And I'm telling you, we are tripping over red flags. 99 out of 100 of these mass shootings, and we've seen them just in the most recent ones that you've mentioned, is that we all saw it coming. And then you add the propensity for violence, you know, and a gun on top of that, access to a weapon, and now you have the perfect storm. And so what I would say, it's not just the onus on the police chief. The police chief needs to be ready for when it happens, but the community, parents, schools, you know, human resources, you name it, insert any, you know, group entity here. Everyone needs to build a culture in their own corner of the world, a culture of reporting, a culture of threat management. So when someone says, listen, I have a relative that is living with me that has some mental issues and has made some threats. But instead, what happens is people remain silent and then later say, wow, yeah, we saw his post on social media. We really could have predicted that. And I guess that is where I'm running out of patience. And I say that lovingly, but is that we have to stop tripping over red flags. And it's going to take all of us, not just the police side of things, the response side. It's going to take all of us on the prevention side.
What do you think are some of the barriers to that, that sort of culture of, you know, preparation and threat management? I'm just thinking of situations in schools where it seems like everyone in the school knows that this kid is, or, you know, I'm not trying to pick on kids or anything like that, but, you know, the kid's drawing violent artwork and making threats about killing people. And nobody seems to respond with appropriate urgency. I mean, there's obviously some sort of, people are concerned and phone calls get made and so forth, but inevitably in situations like this, you look back and say, if only this had been taken care of or taken more seriously. I'm curious from your perspective, what do you think some of the barriers are to people taking those kinds of potential threats, the red flags that you talk about, more seriously?
So you've just hit on, you know, what is now my second mountain. And I call it my second mountain because my first mountain was, you know, climbing the career ladder, you know, becoming a police chief. And this second mountain for me is exactly that. This is why I get up in the morning with this fire in my belly, because I am going around speaking to schools. In fact, to your question, school districts, one example of a failure to report is, what if we're wrong? Mm-hmm. What if this kid was just verbalizing, you know, and venting, and it's harmless? And we also have been really conditioned with the culture of, quote, snitches get stitches, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I talk to schools, and I just got done talking to two school districts that came together and brought me in, and I said, let's bring back Tattletale Tuesday, where, you know, you can talk about, you know, this person has maybe written, you know, an essay or, you know, or posted something, because that it's called leakage, is that 9 times out of 10, a shooter has leakage. They've posted something. They post a foreshadow of what they're going to do, or they tell certain individuals. And then even bringing it to the shooting that happened in my city at 9:30 in the morning, that shooter made a declaration to his coworkers on the manufacturing plant floor. And he said, if I get called into the office today, I'm going to shoot every MFer in here. And they knew him to have a gun. Not one person reported it to management. And in talking to them after the fact, it's because that guy's angry all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd worked there for a while and he hadn't done anything. And, oh, you know, I don't want to get the guy in trouble. What if we're wrong? And it's this culture of reporting. And that is what we need to turn on its head. So that's one barrier, is people just think, oh, what if I'm wrong? Barrier number two, I want to tell someone, I don't know who. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Do I go to a counselor? Do I take it to my boss? You know? And then barrier three, once someone does that, they've gone to the right place, right? Then we have left hand not being introduced to right hand. So no one does this threat matrix. It's the, you know, they sit on the information and we learn later, wow, that was reported to management, but no one did anything, you know, or the social worker knew about that. And, you know, or the police department has a report, but they weren't talking to one another. And this is why, this is again, why I'm going around and speaking on this, is because systems need to be put in place. And this is where I go back to preparation. Police departments prepare for response. Now we have to have different entities preparing with a threat matrix, a team of people that can look at this individual and say, all right, here's the reported threat. Now, does this individual past performances indicative of future behavior? Do they have violent tendencies? And then you add, you know, to this threat matrix. Now, final question, do they have access to a firearm, you know, or have they, you know, filed for a firearm owner's identification card or a conceal and carry license? And now we have, you know, we're mounting evidence, but that's the problem, is this stuff is slipping through the cracks. And until we get teams of threat management put together in place with matrix and systems and processes, then people are still going to go, gosh, what do I do? So those are just the top three barriers to reporting.
Those sound like really important barriers to tackle, though, and very insightful. As you were talking, I could just sort of hear where you were going with some of that. And it's not mass violence, but in the other hat I wear is I'm a psychologist and I work a lot with maltreated kids, and we hear the same thing all the time, is someone knows that the kid is being harmed and they don't know who to tell, or they tell someone and that there's maybe a less than desirable response, or maybe we shouldn't make as big a deal out of this. Maybe we're getting something wrong, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
And it just, as you were talking, I could just really see the parallels in those kinds of situations.
So yeah, exactly. And that's the,
in some ways.
Yeah, that's the message right there. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what I'm saying, is that we have to live on the prevention side, and it takes a village.
Yeah. Yeah. If our listeners, after hearing you talk and share these pearls of wisdom, wanted to reach out to you and learn more from you, how would they get in touch with you?
Yeah, you just need to go to kristenzeman.com and you can, you know, book an appointment with me. We can talk about it. I'm always open to hearing what other people have as ideas, you know, and then let me come talk to your organization. Let me talk about, you know, prevention of the unthinkable and preparing for, you know, and so let's keep the conversation going. I'm trying to start a movement here, and anybody who wants to join the movement can get a hold of me.
Fantastic. Hey, Kristen, thank you so much for sharing your insight and your experiences with us today. It was great to chat with you and learn about what you have to say. And we really want to thank you for joining the Mass Violence Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And this has been another episode of the Mass Violence Podcast. Thank you for listening.